Thanks for having me. It's always great to be here at Perimeter. And so today I'm going to tell you about work that I've been doing for about the past 2 years or so in collaboration with a few people. Nikhil Anand, who's a postdoc at a graduate student at Johns Hopkins. Vincent Genest, who's actually a postdoc in the math department at MIT. Ami Katz, who's at BU. And then Zuhair Kanker, who's a postdoc at Urbana-Champaign. And the basic goal, what I'm going to present today, is kind of a new method or a new approach to studying strongly coupled physics. And so the setup we're going to consider is very straightforward. I want to start off with some conformal field theory in the UV, and then I'm going to deform that theory by adding one or more relevant operators. This is going to break conformal invariance and create an RG flow leading down to some other new IR quantum field theory. And I want to be very agnostic about what the structure of that IR theory could be. It could be another fixed point, it could be a theory with a mass gap, it could be strongly coupled. I just want to consider just very generally quantum field theories in this framework. And notice that the way I've presented it, I mean, this is a very general setup. There are a very large number of problems that can be phrased in this language of UV conformal field theories deformed by relevant operators. But the question I want to ask precisely today is, can I use the information lurking in this UV CFT to describe the entire RG flow? Very naively, all of the information is contained here, and the question I want to ask is, can I extract information about IR physics in an efficient manner from the original fixed point that this RG flow originates from? And so more concretely, what I want to actually study about the IR is I want to study the low energy spectrum, so I want to know what are the first few energy eigenstates, and I want to compute dynamical observables associated with them. So things like correlation functions of local operators, or ideally things like the PDF of the proton. And so this kind of perspective of thinking about quantum field theories as arising from conformal field theories fits in very nicely with the more broader conformal bootstrap program. So the conformal bootstrap program tries to use very general principles, things like conformal symmetry, unitarity, causality, to constrain possible conformal field theories. So a given CFT can be characterized by its operator content, so the spectrum of operators characterized by their scaling dimension and spin quantum numbers, and then the OP coefficients that relate these two things together. And so that's what I'm going to talk about as CFT data, is the spectrum of operator scaling dimensions and the corresponding OP coefficients. And then what the bootstrap tries to do is use these very general principles to constrain the possible combinations of these that actually correspond to valid CFTs. If you just give me a random list of scaling dimensions and OP coefficients, they're not going to correspond to a valid CFT. And so this is trying to figure out the specific combinations that do. And the advantage of this general symmetry-based approach is that it's non-perturbative. So I can do this to study strongly coupled conformal field theories. I don't need a Lagrangian to study this. Everything is phrased solely in terms of scaling dimensions and OP coefficients. And I can apply it in any space-time dimension. So it's a very general kind of tool for studying conformal field theories. And so broadly speaking, the goal of this program is to map out the space of CFTs, so to find the very particular points in parameter space that correspond to valid conformal field theories. And then the natural next step to do, once you have this, or even as you're finding CFTs and learning about their operator content, is to try to use these as launching points to study the more larger space of quantum field theory, so to study the RG flows connecting these CFTs to each other. And so this is precisely what I'm going to try and consider today. And more specifically, what I want to know is I want to ask the question, is the conformal structure of these UV fixed points, of these CFTs from which these RG flows originate, is the conformal structure of these useful in studying the full RG flow, in studying more general quantum field theories? So to do this, I'm going to propose a method which we're calling conformal truncation. And the idea is very, very straightforward. So we just start with some UV CFT, whatever CFT you want to deform. And then you're going to deform it by one or more relevant operators. Then we can organize the Hilbert space of our UV CFT into representations of the conformal group characterized by their eigenvalue under the conformal Casimir. Now don't worry if this doesn't sound familiar. I'm going to go through this in more detail as we go, but I can organize the Hilbert space by conformal Casimir eigenvalue, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to truncate my Hilbert space and restrict it to some smaller finite dimensional subspace by setting some maximum Casimir eigenvalue Cmax and only keeping states below this threshold. When I do that, if I only work in this truncated subspace, my Hamiltonian is now a finite dimensional matrix, so I can just diagonalize it numerically, And the resulting eigenvalue, the resulting eigenstates of this truncated Hamiltonian are an approximation to the true eigenstates of the full theory. And so I can use these approximate eigenstates to study dynamical observables like correlation functions. And so the big punchline is that this method is a way of trying to use CFT data to study dynamics of more general quantum field theories. So this is just the basic setup. Start with some UV CFT and the relevant deformation you're going to consider. That data gives you your Hamiltonian. So you just have the CFT Hamiltonian plus whatever deformation you're going to have. We then truncate by setting some maximum Cmax, and so only cutting out a piece of the Hamiltonian. We then just pretend that this truncated matrix is our Hamiltonian, diagonalize it, and look at the resulting spectrum and observables like correlation functions. So today, I'm going to focus on the specific application, for the most part, of scalar field theory in 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1 dimensions, just to kind of test this method out and see how it works. But I really want to stress that this framework is very general. We can apply it in any number of dimensions. It's not limited to 2 and 3 dimensions. And we can apply it to any CFT, not just scalar field theory, like I'm going to consider today. Okay. So here's kind of the rough outline. First, just to give you some sort of intuition for these Hamiltonian truncation type methods, I'm going to talk about a simple quantum mechanics example known as the Rayleigh-Ritz method. And then once we have that under our belts, I'll then talk in more detail about the overall framework we have for applying Hamiltonian truncation to general CFTs. And then once we have this method, we want to test it. So I'm going to consider two examples. First, I'm going to talk about the RG flow in two dimensions from free scalar field theory to the 2D easing model. And then in 3D, I'll talk about a large N example where we study scalar field theory at large N. Then I'll talk a little bit about current work we're doing on trying to study the 3D easing model. And then at the very end, I'll talk about kind of some future directions and applications that we're considering, in particular, some new ideas we have on applying this method to studying gauge theories. Okay. So the idea of Hamiltonian truncation is actually quite old. So it was originally developed by Lord Rayleigh in the mid-1800s. And then was put on much more rigorous kind of technical footing by Walter Ritz at the turn of the century. And the idea is incredibly simple. Just start with some complete basis of states, whatever basis you want to work with, and then just truncate that basis. Only keep part of it, so restrict it to some finite dimensional subspace. You can then evaluate the Hamiltonian matrix elements in this restricted subspace, giving you some finite dimensional truncated Hamiltonian, which is just a piece of the full Hamiltonian. And then you just pretend that H trunk is your Hamiltonian, diagonalize it, and look at the resulting eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And so a classic example in quantum mechanics that you can apply this to is the anharmonic oscillator. So you take the original simple harmonic oscillator and then add to it just a quartic term. And very famously, if I try to study this in perturbatively as an expansion in lambda, that series is actually asymptotic and doesn't converge. But an alternative approach that I can take is just use the original harmonic oscillator basis states, the familiar evenly spaced states that we're used to, use that basis to write out the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian has two pieces. It has the diagonal piece associated with the original harmonic oscillator, and then it has this quartic term right here. And the only reason why I'm spelling this out in so much detail is these matrix elements right here are kind of tree-level matrix elements that only involve like one insertion of x to the fourth, and only mix kind of nearby energy levels. So the main punchline is just that computing these is incredibly simple. So constructing the Hamiltonian is very easy. And then you restrict your basis by setting some maximum energy level in the original harmonic oscillator piece. So just set some n max, and then that gives you some finite dimensional matrix. You can then diagonalize this matrix and look at the resulting eigenvalues. And so here on this plot, we have the energy eigenvalues of your truncated matrix as a function of the truncation parameter n max. So as we go to the right, we're including more and more states in our basis. And then we're comparing them to the exact energy eigenvalues that you get if you just solve Schrodinger's equation directly. And what we find is that the results converge remarkably quickly, especially if I really only care about the first few energy eigenstates. And so I can even get a very good approximation to the lowest energy eigenstate to the ground state just by diagonalizing a 2x2 matrix. And the nice thing about this is that it converges rapidly even for strong coupling. So here I've set lambda, here I've chosen lambda of 1 in units of m, but you can set it larger to be like 30, 40, 50. And if you haven't done this, I totally encourage you trying to do this. It takes like 10 minutes in Mathematica, and it's actually like quite amazing like how well this approximation works. And so the nice thing about, okay, so sorry, I'll just say really quickly. This is all we're doing. Like, this, in a nutshell, is all I'm going to be talking about today. It's just this basic idea, but just applied to quantum field theory. And so the nice thing about these Hamiltonian truncation methods is they rephrase your problem into a very simple question, which is just, what's a good basis? Okay? The only reason why this anharmonic oscillator example worked so well was just because the eigenstates of the simple harmonic oscillator have large overlap with the low-energy eigenstates of the anharmonic oscillator. And so what you want to ask is, you want to ask, like, this very general question, which is, I think, much bigger than the specific applications I'm going to consider today, which is just, what's a good basis to use, or what's a typical part of the Hilbert space that has large overlap with low-energy states? And so the proposal I'm going to consider today is what we're calling conformal truncation. And since we're viewing our quantum field theory as arising from a UV conformal field theory, our proposal is, oh, just use the natural basis for this UV CFT. So just use the CFT basis to truncate your Hamiltonian to study the full quantum field theory. Now, this is obviously not the only basis you could choose. There are a lot of other alternative frameworks that have been considered. For the most part, they've all been restricted to 2D. And so one thing we're excited about with our proposal is that it should work in any number of dimensions. But yeah, so this is what we're going to consider. OK, so what's the basis? The natural basis for a CFT is states created by local operators, O of x. I'm interested in working in momentum space, so all I'm going to do is I'm just going to Fourier transform the state created by O of x to obtain our basis states. Okay? These states are characterized by their eigenvalue under the quadratic Casimir of the conformal group. If you think in terms of ADS CFT, the conformal Casimir eigenvalue is just dual to some bulk mass. So you can think very physically in ADS terms that this is just the mass of some bulk field. So it's identified by its Casimir eigenvalue, its momentum, and then its invariant mass, mu, which is just p squared. Okay. For those of you who aren't familiar with the conformal Casimir, here it is written in terms of the generators of the conformal group. But really, all you need to know is that roughly the eigenvalue scales like the scaling dimension squared. Okay. And for those of you who are familiar with ADS CFT, you might recognize these states. These are just the very familiar Poincaré patch states that we're used to dealing with, which makes sense because we're going to consider deformations that preserve Poincaré invariants. OK. Now we have our basis identified by Casimir eigenvalue, momentum, and invariant mass. But we have one slight problem, which is that every single operator actually defines a continuum of states. Parameterized by its invariant mass mu. So mu is a continuous parameter. I want to put this on a computer and diagonalize a finite dimensional Hamiltonian, so I need to discretize this parameter mu in some way. Now, there are a bunch of different ways you could choose to do this. What I'm going to choose to do is I'm going to integrate my original states against some weight function parameterized by some parameter k. If I want to make k discrete, then I need to restrict my integration range to some finite interval. And so I'm just going to implement a hard cutoff lambda on this range of integration. And so the main punchline, so really all you need to take away from this slide is just we're discretizing mu by introducing a new parameter k. And to do so, we've introduced a hard cutoff lambda. And what we obtain is a discrete basis of Casimir eigenstates, of eigenstates of the quadratic Casimir of the conformal group. OK. So we now have two parameters with which to truncate our basis. We have the conformal Casimir, which, like I said before, basically is just dual to the bulk mass in ADS. So you can just think of this as kind of the number of fields you're keeping in ADS, or in CFT, just the number of operators you're keeping. And then this other parameter, Kmax. This Kmax sets kind of the resolution of each individual operator, which you can think of in ADS as just kind of the bulk resolution of the field. And Cmax is a very physical parameter. So we expect good convergence in Cmax. We expect to not have to set Cmax very large before we get very good results. Whereas Kmax is this totally artificial discretization parameter that we inserted by hand. And so we don't have any good reason to expect good convergence in Kmax. So in practice, we expect to have to set this to be large and Cmax to be small. OK?
Excuse me?
Yes, yeah.
If we were in two dimensions and we put this on a lattice, that would be. So this Cmax,
yes,
the identification on the quasi-primaries of the CFT?
Exactly, yes, yeah. So yeah, so in the 2D example, yeah, exactly.
It's Kmax then within each
would be for each quasi-primary? Yeah, exactly. If you want to think about this, Cmax is just saying how many quasi-primaries you're keeping, and then Kmax is telling you how many descendants of those quasi-primaries you're keeping, basically. Global descendants.
Global descendants.
Exactly, Okay, so if you want to think of this in terms of ADS, you have this nice picture where we're imposing a UV cutoff, so that introduces some UV brain. And then our parameter Kmax we can think of as giving rise to an effective IR cutoff. And then we have bulk fields. Our operators are dual to bulk fields, kind of describing this regime between our UV and IR cutoffs. And setting C is just setting some cutoff in invariant mass, and so it's just telling you how many fields you're keeping up to some cutoff scale in ADS. Now, I just want to stress that even though we have this nice ADS picture for kind of understanding conceptually what we're doing, I'm not going to be relying on it at any point. All the calculations are going to be done solely in terms of the quantum field theory with no appeal to ADS. This just kind of gives us a nice conceptual picture to kind of organize our thoughts.
Would you ever consider adjusting Kmax according to the value?
That's a good question. So right now we're doing, that's a very good question. So right now we're doing the very dumb thing of just setting a universal value for everybody, just because very roughly if I think of this as setting the IR cutoff, I want to go down to some, like I want to be able to set my IR cutoff to be as low as possible. But you are right. That's a really good question. So we haven't experimented much with that. But it seems totally reasonable that you would think that as I go to higher energies or higher Casimir, I don't care as much about the detailed structure of that. So I in theory, have like less resolution for the higher O states. But yeah, we haven't played with that at all. But that's a very good question. Okay, great. So that's our basis. So then we need to construct the Hamiltonian. So we're going to start off with some conformal field theory, deform it by one or more relevant operators. This gives rise to a Hamiltonian, which is the CFT Hamiltonian plus a correction. Our states, by construction, are eigenstates of the CFT Hamiltonian, so all we need to do is figure out the matrix elements associated with this deformation. But the nice thing is that our basis states are built from local operators in the CFT. Our deformation is also a local operator in the CFT. And so these Hamiltonian matrix elements relating different Casimir eigenstates are just equivalent to CFT three-point functions. They're just Fourier transforms of three-point functions. And so these Hamiltonian matrix elements are just given by the OPE coefficients of the original UV CFT. And so now we've realized, now we've accomplished the goal I initially set out, which is to study quantum field theories in terms of CFT data. The scaling dimensions of the operators set your basis, and the OPE coefficients give you your Hamiltonian. Now, to define a Hamiltonian, I have to choose a quantization scheme. We are going to choose to work in light cone quantization. So I define new light cone parameters. I choose some spatial direction to be special. I define these light cone coordinates, t plus or minus x. And so my Hamiltonian is going to be the generator of translations in this x plus direction. Okay, so that's the overall framework. Start with UV states created by local operators. We then truncate it to some finite dimensional space by setting some Cmax and Kmax. We use the OP coefficients of the original CFT to construct the light cone Hamiltonian P+. Then diagonalize that Hamiltonian to obtain approximate mass eigenstates for the full IR quantum field theory of CFT plus deformations. And then we use those eigenstates to study dynamical quantities, like correlation functions of local operators. Oh, I was trying to find the clock. Okay, great. So we have this framework, but the natural question to ask is, all right, does it work? How well does it converge? Like, is it a good approximation to truncate in Cmax? And so we have this overall framework, but what we need to do is we need to test it in a regime where we have known results to compare with and see how well our framework converges to the correct answer. And so today I'm going to consider two examples. First, we're going to start off in 2D, where our CFT is just free scalar field theory. I'm then going to add to it quartic interaction, tune to the critical coupling, and flow to the 2D easing model. And in the 2D easing model in the IR, I have plenty of analytic results to compare to. And then we're going to go to 3D, and we're going to study a simple large N example, where again, we have analytic results to compare to. And so even though this 3D example is very simple, I just want to stress that this is really kind of one of the first examples of Hamiltonian truncation applied in 3D. And then finally, in the future, I'll talk very briefly at the very end about pushing on to not just study 3D large N theories, but try to study the 3D easing model, so repeating this 2D story in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And then also, we're hoping to go on and study more general theories, including cage theories. Okay, great. So we're in 2D. Our UV CFT, like I said before, is just a free scalar field theory. We're going to deform it by the following two operators. We're going to add a mass term and a quartic interaction. And the advantage of starting from free field theory is that I have all the data I want. I can compute any OP coefficient. And so this is kind of a nice place to start for us to understand the method, is to start off in free field theory where we have plenty of data to play with as far as constructing the basis and constructing the Hamiltonian. Now, there's one technical note about 2D that I just want to go through very, very quickly. Our field phi, our scalar field phi, satisfies the equations of motion. And so our basis, our Hilbert space, kind of naturally splits up into left moving modes and right moving modes, just associated with d plus or d minus derivatives acting on phi. Because we're working in light cone quantization, these left moving modes, d plus phi, are actually non-dynamical, and you can integrate them out. And so all of our basis states are just going to be built by these right moving states, d minus phi. Now, the reason this is important, or the only reason why I'm saying this, is that these states are annihilated by p plus, which means that any operator created from them has zero invariant mass. And so all of my basis states in this specific example of free scalar field theory in 2D, they all have mu equal to zero, and so there is no parameter mu to discretize. And so the only reason I'm bringing this up is that in this specific example, I only have one truncation parameter, and that's this conformal chasm here. Now, this is very specific to free field theory in 2D, or any theory where I have holomorphic, like purely holomorphic states. But if I considered more general 2D conformal field theories or higher dimensional conformal field theories, I would have both C and K. But in this example, we only have C as our truncation parameter. Okay, great. So we need to construct the basis. And specifically, what we need to find is we need to find all primary operators in free field theory. Very schematically, these take the following form. The local operators are just linear combinations of derivatives acting on phi. And so we just need to find the particular combinations of these that correspond to primary operators. Now, I just want to say, I'm not going to go into any detail about this procedure, but surprisingly, this is the main bottleneck. This is the hard thing for us to do, is just finding the combinations that correspond to primary operators. And so kind of the main focus of our work, or the main thing we've had to work on, is just finding an efficient way to go through and quickly find the combinations that correspond to primary operators. But once we have those, it's very easy to construct the Hamiltonian, because we're in free field theory, and so our basis states can be expressed in terms of Fock space states. And then we can easily compute the sort of tree level, just single insertion of phi to the fourth interactions to construct the Hamiltonian. And so these are very simple to compute, and so once we have the basis, constructing the Hamiltonian is very straightforward. Okay, great. So specifically, what do we expect? So we're starting off with free scalar field theory, deforming it by a mass term and a phi to the fourth interaction. For generic values of the coupling, I don't have any predictions, unless I'm in a perturbative regime, for what to expect from this theory. But as I dial this coupling lambda, the quartic coupling, what I find is that for some special value lambda star, the mass gap closes, and this theory flows to a conformal field theory, an IR fixed point, in the same universality class as the 2D easing model. And so at this critical value lambda star, I expect my free scalar field to flow to the 2D easing model. But I don't just get out information about this IR fixed point, I actually get information about the entire RG flow. And what I expect is that my operators in my original scalar field theory, like phi and phi squared, flow to operators in the low dimension operators in the easing model. So odd operators I expect to flow to sigma, and even operators I expect to flow to epsilon. Now, what's nice about studying physics at this fixed point is that the 2D easing model is a minimal CFT, so I have plenty of data to compare to. And in 3D, we can have the exact same story, and I have numerical bootstrap results to compare to. And so this gives me a regime where I can check my results. But I just want to stress, I can study this for any value of lambda, it's just that I have analytic results to compare to when I go to this critical point and flow to the easing model. But more generally, if I deform away from this slightly, if I correct lambda star by some small amount delta lambda, then I don't flow exactly to the easing model. I flow to a theory with a mass gap instead. But since I expected my even operators, phi to the fourth, to flow to the even operator in the easing model, epsilon, this deformation perturbing away from the critical point is just the same thing as deforming the easing model by epsilon, which is its equivalent by tuning away from the critical temperature. And so the nice thing is that in 2D, this theory is still integrable, and epsilon deformation is very simple to describe, and so I again have analytic results to compare to. And so this gives me a way of testing the method near a critical point. But in 3D, these results are totally unknown. These results are unknown. And so once we go to 3D and we tune to the critical point and study physics around in the vicinity of the 3D easing model, then this can give us new data that we could then hopefully compare to experimental results. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to start with free scalar field theory, go near the critical coupling, and then in the IR at low energies, we expect our results to match that of the easing model deformed by epsilon. Okay, so the first thing we can look at is the eigenvalue spectrum. So I construct my basis of primary operators, I truncate at some delta max, I diagonalize the Hamiltonian, and I look at the resulting energy eigenstates, or equivalently the resulting mass eigenstates. And so what this plot shows is the resulting mass eigenvalues as a function of the coupling lambda. So I'm just going to dial the coupling. And what we've done is we've evaluated this at various finite values of delta max and then extrapolated to try and take the large delta max limit to try and get the true eigenvalues. And so these error bars correspond to the uncertainty in that extrapolation. And so what we see is that when lambda is zero and the theory is free, the first three lowest eigenvalues are the one particle state. The lowest even particle is just the two particle state with mass 4m squared. And then the second lowest odd is the three particle state. So this is just the one, two, and three particle thresholds. Then as I slowly turn on lambda, I find that these eigenvalues get corrections. And I can compare these to perturbation theory and find that they agree up to some value of lambda. But then as I keep going, I find that these eigenvalues go to zero at some special value of lambda. So this is the critical point that I expect to be described by the 2D easing model. And so this is the regime in this vicinity of this value of lambda is what I want to study. And so we can look at the value we get. We find that the critical coupling in units of 4 pi is 1.84. So this is a very strongly coupled fixed point. So now let's try and study this theory in the regime of that coupling. We don't just get eigenvalues out, we get full eigenstates. And so we can use these to compute real-time correlation functions. And so, for example, if I wanted to study two-point functions, we're working with momentum eigenstates. And so kind of a nice representation of two-point functions is the spectral density, which is just a decomposition of a two-point function in terms of mass eigenstates. And so computing the spectral density rho of mu, this is going to be the main observable we study. Computing this is exactly equivalent to just computing the two-point function in position space. And in practice, it turns out it's actually going to be simpler for us to consider the integrated spectral density. So I just take rho and then integrate it up to some value of mu and look at this function, this integrated spectral density as a function of mu, which just corresponds to kind of the cumulative sum of overlaps of whatever operator we're considering a two-point function of with my mass eigenstates. Okay, so let's do a simple example. One very special operator is the stress energy tensor, T mu nu, and a nice component of it is the trace. In 2D, the trace of the stress tensor just corresponds to the component T plus minus. Near the critical points, because I know that the theory should be described by the easing model deformed by epsilon, I know that the trace should be equivalent or should be given by just m gap, so just whatever the lowest eigenvalue is, times epsilon. M gap I can extract from the spectrum. I just look at the eigenvalues, and that tells me exactly what M gap is. And then all of the parameters then are fixed, and so I have a concrete prediction for what I expect the trace to do near the critical point. But notice that this is proportional to M gap, which means that the trace vanishes as I go to the critical point. So what I expect is that as I tune lambda to this critical value lambda star and the eigenvalues hit zero, I expect the trace to vanish in the IR. And what's nice about this is that this is a signature that my IR theory is described by conformal field theory. Okay, great. So this is the integrated spectral density of T plus minus. And what I'm going to do, so it's just integrated spectral density as a function of eigenvalue mu. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to slowly vary the coupling lambda and watch how this behaves. Now, currently at lambda equals zero, this is just a free massive theory, and so this curve that we get numerically matches exactly what you would expect for just a free massive scalar. The points actually correspond to the actual eigenvalues, the actual contributions, and then the dotted lines are just an interpolation that we've drawn between the various points. And for just to be really precise, we're going to do this for delta max of 34, which is roughly 10,000 basis states. And so as we turn on the coupling and we slowly go, what we see is that the theory deforms. So two things happen. One, the eigenvalue, which started at the two particle threshold, slowly drifts to the left. This is what we saw before in the plot of the eigenvalues. And then the curve deforms. And as we get closer and closer to the critical coupling, what we find is that the trace vanishes as the eigenvalues hit zero. And so what we see is that, yes, this IR theory, when the mass gap hits zero, is described by a CFT. We can actually see the trace vanishing. Now, of course, it only vanishes at very low energies because this full theory of scalar field theory isn't a conformal field theory. It's only in the IR that it flows to one. And so once we get to scales above the coupling lambda, we find that now the trace does deviate from zero and we do have non-trivial behavior. And eventually, if you keep going, then this will asymptote to just the free scalar behavior you would expect in the UV. Okay, any questions about this first example? Because we're gonna be looking at like a ton of plots like this, so. Okay, cool. Now, I showed you results for a very specific value of delta max, but the question is, did I really have to go that high? And so here, I'm looking at the exact same plot, so just an integrated spectral density of T plus minus at some intermediate value of the coupling. And what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna vary delta max. So I'm gonna vary the number of states I keep in my basis. The blue dots correspond to the curve I showed you before, so our delta max of 34. And the other values correspond to 16, 24, and 30 for my delta max cutoff. And just to remind you, I'm really truncating in conformal Casimir, but it's easier to think in terms of delta max because it just kind of grows linearly. Conformal Casimir is roughly just this value squared, or behaves like this value squared. And so what we find is two things. One, it converges rather quickly, but more importantly, it converges from the IR up. So as I increase delta max, I find that even delta max of 16 does a great job of describing the IR, which is precisely the regime I want to study. And as I increase delta max, I find that the agreement slowly moves higher and higher in energy scale. And so this is great. This is exactly what I wanted. I really want to focus on the IR. I really care about low energy physics. And so what I see is that low values of delta max are sufficient for doing so. So let's zoom in and look at this IR regime that we expect to be described by the easing model. And so here, oh yeah, sorry.
Can you go back?
Yep, yeah, of course.
Since everything is integrable, do you know the analytic prediction for these curves? Like how far?
So I'm gonna show you on the next, plot. So this curve, this whole flow is not integrable.
Oh.
It's only, because this is not really, like this whole theory is not the easing model deformed by epsilon. It's really scalar field theory flowing down to that. And so I don't have predictions for what happens in this regime. I only have predictions right down here, which is exactly, that was a perfect time question because I'm gonna show you on the next plot. Okay, great. So we're gonna zoom in. This just shows exactly what I had said before, which is that even at delta max of 16, we do a relatively good job of describing the IR physics. And then we can compare this, as you asked, to the prediction from the easing model. And so what we find is that in the IR, the regime that I expect to be described by the easing model, we find agreement between the prediction from this integrable theory and the behavior we find. And that the disagreement, once we start getting order one corrections, once we hit energy scales of order the coupling lambda. And so once we hit this coupling scale, then that's exactly precisely the regime when we would expect this theory to deviate from the predictions from the easing model. Okay. But we don't just have to look at the trace, we could look at other operators. And so one kind of nice phenomenon we expect to see is that near the critical point, as I approach lambda star, I expect all operators in my original theory to flow to the lowest dimension operators in the easing model. So at very low energies, I expect them to be dominated by the lowest dimension operators in the IR. So this is a nice prediction. I expect all my Z2 odd operators to map to the lowest Z2 odd operator in the easing model, sigma. And I expect all the lowest Z2 even, or sorry, all the Z2 even operators to map to epsilon. And so what I expect is universal behavior at low energies. If I look at the spectral densities of these different operators, I expect that at away from the critical point, they should disagree, but as I flow to the critical point at low energies, they should all start to agree. And so for example, if I look at just any phi to the 2n operator, I expect this to flow to epsilon. And so I expect them all to agree in the IR at the near the critical coupling as I look at low energies.
Sorry, when you say that they would flow to epsilon, you mean that they would have some overlap? You mean that they would have some overlap with epsilon?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So
they would also overlap with some other operator, no?
They will So what I can do is I can, so let's just take a specific example. So like phi squared, I could write out phi squared as an expansion in terms of easing model operators. So I'd have epsilon, then plus like d squared epsilon, plus like other quasi-primaries that are higher. But those are going to be suppressed by higher values of mu. And so as I go to, this is just a simple scaling argument. As I go to very small values of mu, I expect those higher dimensional operators to be suppressed compared to the epsilon piece. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Okay, great. So let's look at a couple even operators. So we're gonna look at the integrated spectral density for phi squared, phi to the fourth, and phi to the sixth. And this is exactly the same as the trace before. I'm just gonna show you the integrated spectral density as a function of mu for various values of lambda. When we start off at free field theory, so lambda equals zero, we notice that these are very, very different. Phi squared only talks to two particle states, so its threshold is at four. Phi to the fourth and phi to the sixth, they talk to four and six particle states, and so their threshold is way over here. So up until values of 16 and 36 m squared, they're just zero. Okay, so now as we turn on the coupling, two things happen. Just like before, the eigenvalues move to the left, and these functions start to deviate from their free field theory result, free field theory behavior. And then as we approach the critical points, what we find is that they agree in the IR. So we find exactly the universal behavior that we were expecting, where they're all flowing to epsilon in the IR. And then they deviate as I go to higher energies, just like before the trace deviated from exactly the prediction of m-gap epsilon as we went to higher energies. So we can again zoom in on this. And so what we see is this behavior that I just talked about. We see universal behavior for the low energy eigenvalues. And then as we go to higher eigenvalues above the value lambda, these begin to deviate. They lose their universal behavior precisely because of the corrections you were talking about, where these have different contributions from like d squared epsilon and higher dimensional operators. And we can again compare it to the easing model prediction. So here's the prediction for epsilon for this particular value of m gap. And so don't be fooled by the fact that phi to the sixth seems to agree for much longer. This is just a coincidence. As you look at different values of phi to the n and you keep going, like phi to the eighth will be below and they'll keep fanning out. And so it just so happens that phi to the sixth agrees for quite a while. Really the agreement that you should be focusing on is just this region right here where they all agree with the Easing model prediction. And in case this wasn't clear, I just want to stress, like this deviation from the Easing prediction, this is not truncation error. This is purely the statement that phi to the fourth theory isn't really the Easing model. It's just described by it in the IR. And so this deviation from the Easing model prediction is actually physical and not error from the fact that we've truncated in delta max. Okay. Okay, the last spectral density I want to show you is the spectral density of T minus minus, so another component of the stress tensor. It turns out that the integrated spectral density of this operator corresponds to the Zamolodnikov C function. This function obeys the C theorem, which was proven by Zamolodnikov in the mid 80s, which says that this function right here, C of mu, which is just proportional to the integrated spectral density of T minus minus, is a monotonically decreasing function along in the entire RG flow, and it interpolates between the central charges of the UV and IR fixed point. And so the fact that this is monotonically decreasing tells you that CUV is greater than CIR, for example. And so now you guys all understand the C theorem because it's trivially obvious in this representation that this is a monotonically decreasing function because it's just an integral of a positive function. And the fact that it matches to CUV in the IR and UV, C in the IR and the UV, just corresponds to the central charge is literally defined in terms of the two-point function of T minus minus, which is exactly what we're plotting. Okay, great. So we can make a similar plot. This is a plot of the integrated spectral function, integrated spectral density of T minus minus, or equivalently the C function, as a function of mu for some intermediate, for some value of lambda. And so what we see, what I really like about this plot is that this shows you the entire RG flow. And so what we see is that in the UV, this asymptotes to the free scalar central charge of one. And then as we go towards the IR, and as we approach the scale associated with the naive dimensional analysis scale associated with lambda, we find that we get deviations from this free field theory prediction. And then as we go to the IR, this theory has a mass gap. And so the central charge in the IR should correspond to zero. And so this plot shows you like the entire RG flow from free scalar field theory down to a theory with a mass gap. Now, what you would obviously like to do with this is you would want to tune to the critical point and read off the central charge of the Easing model. And so what you would expect to see is that as this flows down, you would expect for some range of scales below the scale lambda, this thing is gonna flatten out at 1/2 the central charge value for the Easing model, and then eventually go to zero because the theory has a mass gap. Unfortunately, this function is remarkably sensitive to UV corrections. And so in order to read off this plateau of 1/2, which absolutely does exist, you need to set m gap to be much, much less than your coupling scale lambda. And so you need to be able to push your mass gap to be orders of magnitude, at least two orders of magnitude less than this coupling scale. And you can just see this. This is just a property of the Ising model. You can just look at the corrections to T minus minus from your deformation by epsilon. And you can see that it rapidly deviates and the plateau immediately goes away. Unless you set m gap to be much, much less than the transition scale. And so our truncation to some finite delta max limits our IR resolution. And so we can only push m gap to be so small in practice. This IR scale is roughly given by just lambda squared, the coupling scale over delta max. And so currently, we're unable to resolve this plateau at C of 1/2. But I want to stress that the fact that we're not seeing this plateau, like the fact that in this plot, for example, there is no plateau, that's not truncation error. Like, we're correctly reproducing the function for this value of the mass gap and for this value of the coupling in finite of the fourth theory. It's just that what truncation does, the limitations of this truncation, is that it limits how far I can push m gap down. And so in practice, I would want to up the number of states I include and increase delta max to try and resolve this. Now, we're trying to think of clever ways to not have to push m gap down and just kind of subtract out the correction from, because all that's happening is just in your Ising description, you're getting corrections from epsilon and higher dimensional operators to your spectral density of T minus minus. And so we're trying to think of a clever way to subtract this out, but right now in practice, we're unable to resolve the C of 1/2 that we would expect for the Ising model. Okay, so that's 2D. Next, we're going to move on to 3D. So any questions about 2D? Sorry, before I jump ahead. Yeah?
I think I can understand your last sentence. Why is this not a truncation problem?
Yeah, good. So good. It's a problem with truncation. Yeah, so I should have made this a log plot. That would have made it a little bit easier. So the problem with truncation is it says how far to the left I can go. And that is definitely a problem. I just mean that so all I'm saying, maybe you guys would already have realized this, but naively when we first did this, I expected that even m gap, so long as m gap was somewhat smaller compared to lambda, I definitely expected a plateau to form. And the fact that a plateau doesn't form, that is physical. That's actually definitely true. It's just a property of this function. And you only have a plateau form at C equal 1/2 if you push m gap very, very low. And so all I'm saying is that at these finite values of m gap that we're considering, there's no, the reason we're not seeing a plateau is not due to truncation error. Truncation error is what's limiting how far down I can go. Does that clarify? Or, okay. I'd be happy to explain it more. Okay.
Do you expect that there to be any other 2D CFTs where you can find this?
Yeah, so this is a good question.
The overflow is short.
Yeah. So we have two things working against us. One, the scaling, so for the Ising model, the scaling dimension of epsilon is a little bit low, and so that's part of the reason that we're having this problem, but also it just so happens numerically that the coupling scale is rather small. It's only one or two. And so if you had a theory where you had, so one thing you could hope to do, it's not obvious this is the best thing to do, but you could add a phi to the sixth interaction as well, and then you could tune kind of where the coupling scale is.
And then that
should hopefully give you more breathing room to try to resolve this. The difficulty with that is that you now have to tune two parameters. You have to tune both the phi to the sixth and the phi to the fourth coupling. So in principle, we think we could do this. But we haven't pursued that very carefully or very much so far. Cool, okay. I'll go through 3D relatively quickly so that I can get at the end and talk briefly about gauge theory. The main difference, so if we go to 2+1 dimensions, the main difference is just now that our basis states are no longer annihilated by p squared. We now have an invariant mass mu that we can discretize, and so we're back to having two truncation parameters, both Cmax and Kmax. Okay, so let's consider a large n example. So I could extend my basis to n free fields phi, so just adding some label phi I. I'll again start from free scalar field theory, though now I just have an O-N symmetry relating these N fields phi I. If I restrict to O-N singlets, then the basis of two particle singlets is actually identical to the single field case where you just had no label I. There's no work to do. Constructing the O-N basis, if you're going to restrict to two particles to singlets, is just the same as studying the single field case. We can then, so the only reason I'm saying this is just there's no more work to do. We don't have to keep like n, our basis doesn't grow with n. We can then perturb this theory by adding two deformations, a mass term and a quartic interaction, which preserve the O-N symmetry, which means that I can focus on the singlet sector by itself. And then if I take the large n limit, so if I take n to infinity, keeping this interaction scale kappa fixed, then particle number mixing processes are suppressed by 1 over n. And so to leading order in 1 over n, I expect the different n particle sectors to be independent. The reason this is nice is then I can just focus on low particle states, like just focus on the low particle sector, where it's easier to construct the basis. So in this limit, the other nice thing about this large n limit is that I have analytic predictions. So if I look at the spectral density of phi squared, its contributions are just at leading order in large n are just these chains of bubbles, which I can sum up and get an analytic expression for the spectral density. And so the main the details of this aren't very important. All you can see is just that at high energies, this thing asymptotes to the free field theory expression. As I go to the IR, as I approach scales of order kappa, I expect new scaling behavior in the IR. And then finally, as I go deep into the IR, I expect to find a mass gap. So those are kind of the three features we want to see out of the spectral density of phi squared.
Or 3 plus 1 dimensions?
This is in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Yeah. You could do this also in 3 plus 1. That'd be fine. OK, so here's our results. So this is the phi squared integrated spectral density as a function of mu. We have two truncation parameters now. So we've set delta max to be 41, which since we're only keeping two particle states means we're only keeping 20 operators. So we're keeping very few operators. And then we're setting k max to be 500. So for every operator, we're keeping 500 states because we expect not very great convergence in k max. And then what we find is that the black line corresponds to the theory prediction, the theoretical prediction. The blue dots are our results. Here we have our results normalized by the theoretical prediction, and we find that they agree over a wide range. As we go to the IR, because we have an effective IR cutoff, we start to find a little bit of disagreement as you go to very low eigenvalues. Okay, so now we can zoom in. Oh, so sorry, first I just want to say, before we zoom in, so this curve already shows you kind of the qualitative features. At large behavior, we expect the scaling associated with the free field theory, so this just the scaling dimension of phi squared is just 1. And then as we go down to the IR, and we transition at the scale kappa, we find different scaling, which corresponds to the fact that phi squared gets an anomalous dimension and flows from a scaling dimension of 1 down to a scaling dimension of 2 in the IR. And then if we zoom in, we can also see the corrections from the mass term. And so we can actually see that we're correctly reproducing the behavior associated with a mass gap in contrast to what you would expect if this theory were massless. Similar to before, it doesn't matter if it's not that impressive if I can reproduce this by cranking up the knobs. The question is how rapidly do my results converge? And so here we have the same plot where I've set delta max to be 3, 5, 7, and 9, which just corresponds to keeping 2, 3, 4, and 5 operators. And what we find is just like before, the convergence is most rapid in the IR. And so as I increase delta max, I'm building up the spectral density from the IR up. So the behavior we saw in 2D is repeated here in this 3D example. Yep?
Just remind me how you're generating the blue lines.
Oh, yeah. So in this case, so great. So in the previous example, in 2D, we had dots corresponding to each individual eigenvalue. That's just its contribution to the spectral density, and you're just summing them up. And then we had an interpolating dot. Now there's no interpolating dot. There's no interpolating here because we've added k. Dialing k basically acts as kind of your interpolating function. And so these are all just a ton of dots corresponding to all the different eigenvalues and their contributions. Sorry, thanks for pointing that out. I forget. I neglected to mention that. So that's one reason to think that maybe we don't need to make k so large is that right now, all dialing k up to be really large is doing is just kind of giving you kind of a natural interpolating function. But it'd be worth kind of experimenting to see that, maybe I could just have more spaced out points, but then just draw an interpolating line through them. But we can talk about that after. Great. I'll just say that, so we've tested the framework near a critical point in 2D. We've tested it in 3D with a large n example. And so now the obvious thing to do in 3D would be to try to study the full RG flow from scalar field theory to the 3D Ising model, which is currently unexplored. But a natural question to ask when anybody says that they have a method for studying strongly coupled field theories is, can we use it to describe gauge theories? And obviously, this is one application that we've had in the back of our mind, like from the beginning when we started this work. And so there are two possible ways that you could try to approach this. One, which is the more like obvious way to do it, which is how most approaches currently think about it, is very similar to what we did with scalar fields. Start off with your UVCFT just being free field theory, so it's just a theory of free quarks and free gluons. And then your deformation is to basically gauge the global symmetry. So you add a coupling between your quarks and your gluons, and then add interactions between the gluons, which I've written very schematically here. This creates an RG flow leading down to some presumably confining theory, and you could use this to study QCD. But this approach has a huge problem. And the huge problem is that the deformation, the operators that you deformed your theory by, are not gauge invariant local operators, okay? I mean, it's very obvious. These have manifest A's in them, so A dot J is clearly not a gauge invariant operator. The Hamiltonian is gauge invariant, but that's only because you've integrated this local operator across all of space, okay? And so, if we regulate these inner products, which we had to do, we had to introduce our hard cutoff lambda, if we introduce a hard cutoff that regulates the integral over all space of these operators, that spoils the gauge invariance. And so, as you guys all know, I'm just telling you stuff you already know, but a hard cutoff breaks gauge invariance. But the reason why was because this local operator is not gauge invariance. And so if you want to study QCD in this way, or just gauge theories in this more general way of starting with a free theory and then gauging it, you need to find an alternative regulator. So some sort of regulator that, unlike a hard cutoff, preserves gauge invariance. But there's another way. And the other option would be to not start from free field theory, but to instead start from an already interacting fixed point. So like a Banksacks type fixed point. And so to be very concrete, if I wanted to do 3+1 dimensions and I wanted to study SU3 gauge theory, there's a weakly coupled Banksacks fixed point if I introduce 16 flavors. Now I obviously don't want 16 flavors at the end, so what I do is I can deform this theory by adding a mass term for all but three of the flavors.
Right, 16 in it's weakly coupled in the one over net.
So for this example, alpha is 0.04 at this fixed point. So.
What you mean, because NF is large.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the only reason why I wanted to put out this example is that I don't need to make NC large. I just need to make, you're absolutely right. For given values of NC, I need to push NF to be large. But the nice thing is that I can still keep my number of colors rather small. But yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah. Okay, so then I deform this theory by adding a mass term. This lifts out it lifts out all but three of the flavors, creating an RG flow that again confines and leads down to a QCD, QCD-like theory, or it leads down to QCD. Now the advantage of this approach, in contrast to the previous one, is that all I did was add a mass term, and mass terms are gauge invariant. And so this operator, this local operator, is gauge invariant, which means that I don't need to integrate it all over space to obtain a gauge invariant Hamiltonian. If I insert a hard cutoff, this is still going to preserve gauge invariance. And so I don't need an alternative regulator. I can just work with a hard cutoff. And so if I'm starting from a Banksacks fixed point, there are no conceptual hurdles that I need to overcome, in principle, to study QCD. I don't need to find another regulator like DimReg or PolyVelars or something like that. I can just do the dumb thing of just using a hard cutoff. Of course, the obvious disadvantage is that I'm starting from an interacting fixed point instead of free field theory. And so what do I need? To get this to work, I need the operator spectrum, so I need to know the scaling dimensions of the low operators in my Banksacks fixed point, and I need to know the OPE coefficients. Now, there are two naive ways that I could think of doing this. The obvious way would be to use the conformal bootstrap. It's a CFT, this is what the bootstrap does, and so I could try to use numerical bootstrap results to try and find this Banksacks fixed point and determine the low scaling dimensions, low operator scaling dimensions, and OPE coefficients. But, this is difficult, and there are still some technical challenges that need to be overcome to realizing this with the numerical bootstrap. So another option would be to work with a perturbative Banksacks fixed point and just compute them directly using perturbation theory. So just compute the operator content and OP coefficients as an expansion in alpha. And so like I said, for this example, alpha star for this particular combination of SU3 and NF 16 flavors, alpha star is quite small, so I could believe that I could that this is a good approximation, like only keeping the first couple terms in alpha. And more generally, this is a very general recipe for studying any gauge theory. And so you all can do this. Start with your favorite theory, pick whatever gauge theory you want to study, add in extra matter, so just add in a bunch of crap, until you get to some weakly coupled fixed point, or just to some fixed point in the UV. This could be a Banks-Sachs-like fixed point, this could be something like N equals 4 super Yang Mills. Then, once you've added in that crap to get to a fixed point that you can either study with the bootstrap or study perturbatively, then just remove that extra matter. Add a bunch of mass terms in, lift that stuff out, and it'll flow back to the theory you wanted. So you can go to some weakly coupled fixed point or to some fixed point, calculate the data, remove the extra matter, and then flow down to the theory you want. Yes?
Is it obvious that you will flow back to the theory you wanted?
Yeah, good. It depends. So it does depend slightly on the flow in the sense that you're worried about two things. One, you would be worried about if you have enough separation of scales to really describe the theory you wanted, because if it doesn't flow for very long, then you're not really describing. Like in this example, if the flow from this Banks-Sachs fixed point down to QCD happened very quickly to where it rapidly confined. But then there's a separate question of, do you get back to the theory that you want? That's a good question. For this QCD example, for this QCD example, you can show that you do flow to the same. This is a good question. This is a good question. Naively, I would have just think that all I'm doing is just lifting out the matter. Like the operator content, the matter content that I have is exactly the same as what I would have gotten from just taking the free theory and gauging it. Good. What's an example? What would I be worried about? This is a good question. I would think that in general it should be fine because all I'm doing is lifting out the stuff. That's definitely worth thinking about. The nice thing about this approach is that it could also work for chiral gauge theories. And so to pick a random example, if I started with SU5 with a 10 and a 5 bar, I can add, I forget if it's 4 or 5 adjoints, and find a weakly coupled Banks-Sachs fixed point, and then imagine lifting those out and then flowing to the standard model, or flowing to an SU5 gauge theory. So this is kind of the general approach that we're now pursuing. And we're actually right now trying to consider the specific example of SU3 with NF equals 16, compute the operator content and OP coefficients perturbatively and see what happens when we add this mass term and diagonalize the Hamiltonian.
Sort of connecting to this question. So if you're in 2 plus 1D and you do this trick and you integrate out the matter, then you're going to generate some
transformers. So 3D's confusing. 3D is confusing for a couple reasons. The first is that in 3D, I don't think I expect a weakly coupled fixed point. I guess I would have to do like a 1 over n type expansion. That's fair. Okay, yeah, so that's a good point. So in 3D, yeah, I had to think about what sort of tuning you would have to do to try to forbid generating those sorts of turns. Yeah, that's a good question. But yeah, in principle, you could imagine generating Trent Simons like term.
In 4D, it's not just something I don't know. Can you generate an theta turn?
That's a good question.
Maybe there's a reason why you can't.
So I think so long as I keep some of the species massless, I think I'm fine that I can always get rid of this theta term. That'd be the one thing you might worry about is how to make sure that you're in the right theta vacuum. That's a good question.
But didn't you just start with a large number of flows and then you must many of them?
You could. The one thing I'd be worried about is that let's say I have some very, very large number of flavors in F and then I get rid of all but like 3 of them or some finite number of them. Then I would worry that I'm getting rid of NF guys, and so I'm worried that I might have like an NF over NF type problem. To where just the leading behavior in NF might be compensated for by the fact that I'm getting rid of a huge number of fields. In principle, you could imagine doing this. So that's it. Just to summarize really quickly, the method that I've talked about today is just a general method for studying deformations of conformal field theories in any number of dimensions. And the things we need are just, we need CFT data for the original fixed point. So you just need to know the operator content and the OP coefficient up to some threshold, so for the low dimension operators. And then we can, using that data, using the CFT data, we can compute dynamical observables along the entire RG flow, even at strong coupling. So, thank you.
Okay, we had a lot of questions, but are there any more questions for that?
Yeah.
So, when you lose this, when you truncate, I know that your states, the remaining states, will technically not be completely pure anymore, meaning that.
What do you mean?
Oh, like, you know, if you truncate, then there will be, or when you integrate out stuff, then you essentially get to reduce density matrix. It's for each of the.
Oh, so good. So, go ahead.
So basically, I'm saying that there will be some small violations of unitarity that depend on delta max in your spectral forms and so on. So I'm just asking whether you can detect those.
Good. I don't think I should have violations of unitarity because I'm not. Yeah, good. Okay. So, for the ground state. So Hamiltonian truncation in general, I can think of as just kind of a variational method. So I'm just using some like trial wave function to approximate my states, and it just so happens that I've restricted my trial wave function to live in some to be described by some basis. For the ground state, at least you can show that just. What you get by a variational method and trying to minimize the energy is equivalent to just diagonalizing this truncated Hamiltonian. I think the same story is exactly the same for the higher dimensional states, where I'm just approximating the state with some trial wave function. And so I don't think I should see any violation of unitarity. I mean, if there's something I'm missing
I would have to think about it and see why Giffrey is shaking his head.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a unitary matrix, and yeah. I'm still diagonalizing unitary matrix if I restrict it to some. Yeah. So.
So when you do the 1/1 expansion, how many operators can you include? Practical
to work. Good. That's a good question. That's what we're trying to figure out right now. You mean for the scalar field theory example, or for? So that's what we're trying to figure out right now. So we're just starting. We only had this idea of starting from a bank stack instead of very recently. What we're trying to do is figure out exactly how efficient this is. We're hoping, so based on these preliminary results, we're hoping that even just getting to delta max of 10-ish would be fine, sufficient to get 20%-ish error or something like that on like the lowest states. And that seems very doable. In the sense that even if you tried to do it brute force and had a very inefficient method getting up to those lower. But I totally agree. If you really wanted to go high, I expect it'll blow up very quickly just because the number of states grows very large and also just computing to higher order. Yeah, then the second question is how high in 1/n do you want to go? If you just want to go to leading order versus higher. I don't know. Currently, I don't know yet kind of roughly where our threshold is in practice. But our goal, what we're shooting for right now, is just to get to delta max of 10.
Again.